Thanks for joining us today. My name is Raymond McDaniel, and this is Word Squared. It's a program of the Sweetland Center for Writing, where we ask faculty members to talk with us about their own experiences as writers and how those experiences influence and interact with their roles as teachers. I want to thank our partners, Literati, for hosting us, and WCBN for broadcasting us. A recording of this conversation will be available via Sweetland's website, but not unless we actually have it, so let's get to it. Our guest today is Phoebe Glockner, a writer, illustrator, cartoonist, and mixed media artist. She is an assistant professor at the Stamp School of Art and Design, and some of her works include A Child's Life and Other Stories, and The Diary of a Teenage Girl, a film adaptation of which just recently premiered at Sundance, directed by Marielle Heller, who also, I think, directed a stage adaptation as well. Phoebe has also worked on, is still working on, a set of projects that derive from her experiences researching and visiting Juarez and the families of the young women who have been murdered there. For my part, I just wanted to begin by saying that I have owned several copies of The Diary of a Teenage Girl because every time I let someone borrow my copy, they inevitably fail to return it. It's that kind of book. You feel compelled to lend it, and you also feel compelled to steal it. It's a really difficult work to describe because it's a novel, but it's also illustrated by both the author and the main character. But the illustrations are also sometimes cartoons, and the genres are drawn from all sorts of different categories. All you can really unambivalently say about it is that it works. So my first question is this. Since each of your projects is both distinct from the others and often from predetermined genres, how do you think about form when you are working on a project? How do you go about finding out what something needs to be?
Thank you for that introduction, Raymond. That was great. That's a really good question. Ever since I was a kid, I have found, as you're learning to draw, you're learning to write, you're learning to do anything, I found that when I reach some plateau, like I learned that skill, and I would get frustrated because I wouldn't want to repeat myself. So I would put that skill aside and try to learn something else to combine it with. I guess my brain just works that way. And so after I had my first, I've been doing comics since I was like 14 and getting them published since a few years after that. And they were published in really obscure places. No one ever read them. And so, by some miracle, I had my first book of comics, which was a collection, published, when I was in my 30s. And after I did that, I thought to myself, I can't do that again. I'm not going to have a book that's all comics again. I just can't do that. And I can't exactly tell you why, but I was certainly sure of it. So then, this Diary of a Teenage Girl, which is based on diaries that I actually wrote when I was a teenager, although I just want to repeat, I always have difficulty saying it's autobiographical, simply because it is a point of view, and autobiography somehow sounds like truth, like biography. And how can you call anything truth when it's just one point of view? Same with history. I think it's bull. I can't say that. Okay.
Shift.
Yeah. But at any rate, so when I started writing that novel, I had a real problem because I had the original diary. It was typewritten, because that's what I did. I loved typewriters. I put a piece of binder paper in there and just typed. So I had all these pieces of paper, and it felt so precious to me. Like, I could not alter it, because it was a document, and it was old. Time had passed, so it seemed like it was beyond doing anything but, like, treating it like some voice from the past. But that was very difficult. It wasn't a novel. It was a diary, and there's millions of extraneous characters. There's things that happen that don't lead anywhere. Diaries are like our lives. They're just filled with crap that it doesn't really matter to the story if you're telling one. And all the stories we tell ourselves about ourselves are the essence of what events meant to us. We forget all the extraneous stuff. So anyway, at some point I decided, okay, I will be able to use the diary, the actual diaries, as material. I can change them. I have to change them, or no one is ever going to understand what I mean, what I want to say with this. Oh, and you asked one question, like, how do you figure out what to do?
Yeah, since each project is very much its own thing,
right,
how do you figure out what thing it needs to be?
Okay, well, that book took me years and years to figure it out. I first started... I love old Victorian novels. Like, you know, I have some editions of Zola, and they have, you know, one-page illustrations. And it's beautiful. Lots of Victorian novels have illustrations, and books for adults had them way back then. So I wanted to try it like that. I'd have still illustrations and this diary. It did not work because it drove me crazy, because illustrations like that are redundant of content. So, like, it would be an illustration of what somebody looked like, or, you know, and it just drove me crazy because it wasn't moving. I could not. So anyway, I had the idea of mixing comics and prose. The diary became more prose than day-to-day stuff. But it was hard because I didn't want the comics to interrupt the prose or the prose to interrupt the comics. I didn't want it to feel shocking and distracting. And I don't know if I succeeded in making it as smooth as I wanted it to be, but that was my goal. And there was also this problem about readers. Comics readers were pissed that I had put so many words in here. And people who didn't read comics told me at times that they were kind of distracted by the pictures. But I guess I didn't care because I thought that was the best I could do. And it ended up being what I wanted to do, even though I didn't know beforehand what I wanted to do. So, oh wait, oh, okay. Should I go on?
Please do.
Okay, but a different... Okay, so now I'm working on this book, which is about Mexico. It's not just about murdered women, and I never have described it really. It's about not belonging. It's about being one thing and also another, and neither of them at the same time. I mean, it's about the border. It's about being American. It's about being Mexican. It's about being dead, and it's about being alive. And it started out, indeed, because I was asked to go to Mexico to interview families of women who had been killed. So that's where it started. And I never would have thought to do that on my own. It never would have occurred to me. Especially, I had two kids and their daughters, and murder's kind of scary, very scary. I mean, so...
For those people who aren't familiar, what kind of media are you using?
Oh, okay. It's weird not to have, like, slides. So,
for those of you listening at home, the slides are fantastic.
Thank you. No, I... Okay, I've been to Juarez, like, you know, millions of times. Several times a year I go there. And I've been tracking a family, one family, and a neighborhood. But in the beginning, I just took lots of pictures of the inside of houses, insides of shacks, basically, and the neighborhood where they lived. And I built replicas of those spaces. There's a few people in here who have actually been to my studio. You know, it's got sand on the ground. You know, I need to use it as the desert. And then I have houses and rooms all around. And I tried to copy the rooms of the people where they lived. And then I built dolls. I made dolls. I made every little tiny thing. And populated all these places with these dolls. So I take pictures and do shit to... do
Let's just move on, everyone.
I take pictures of these sets, you know, light them, and you know, I'm not exactly sure what the form will be. I never know what something's going to be in the end. I don't write outlines. I don't really make these plans. It's like I don't even know how I finish any book. I mean, truthfully. So I'm going to do an electronic version and a printed version, and they'll be very different in some ways. I mean, there will be animation in the electronic version. And if you can imagine, suppose you got some animation. If that has any narrative content in it, like if it propels the narrative at all, how are you going to translate that into print? You're going to have to add something else or do something else. So they're not going to, it's not going to be a mirror image, one or the other. It's not going to be a smooth translation. And I mean, I'm really interested in what books are becoming. And so that's kind of an opportunity to screw around with that. But I've been thinking about it for a long time. So, yeah.
That's, even the variety of techniques you're applying there, I think that's interesting in its own right, because it's impossible for a reader or for you to project forward on the basis of what you will do, what you've done previously, mm-hmm. what you're going to do next. So my next question relative to that is, I'm wondering what you think about the relationship between relying on the skills you have, particularly the ones that you've developed very deliberately over time or via education, but also never over-relying on those skills. So I first encountered your work as an illustrator for that version of Ballard's Atrocity exhibit. And I remember thinking quite vividly at the time that whoever this Phoebe Glockner person was, she could render the hell out of anything. Right. And so at that moment, if I projected forward, I could have easily envisioned increasingly expressive and complex forms of illustration and rendering. But in so much of what you've done since, you've used those skills, but you've also used them in complicated ways, or you've deliberately limited them, or sometimes you put them aside completely. Mm-hmm. So as a maker of things, how do you stay open to new skills and new techniques? How do you go about acquiring them?
Hmm. Well, that question kind of has a lot of parts.
I'm like the Swiss Army knife of questions.
Yeah. Basically, most of my work has some narrative content. And I don't really distinguish between the making and the writing. It's all this one kind of thing. That being said... If we're talking about the process of actually making images, I think that's all in the brain. I think that's the brain's work. And what's important to me is what those images mean. And so if I can borrow from things I've done before, or if I can borrow from certain genres, and then somehow make it mean something else or adapt it to what I'm... I don't know if I'm making myself clear at all. But what I'm saying is I don't rely on any particular skill, because I know that the real tool is my brain. So so I'm not a purist in the sense that, you know, I don't know. You know, I get this all the time. Like, people said, why aren't you drawing anymore? And I just think, why are they asking me that? Because the process for me... is very much the same. I have to make these pictures that are saying what I want to say. And how I do it has a lot to do with what it means, and I have to choose that way. And, oh, but you know what? It was really a pain in the butt. When I decided to make these dolls and everything, somehow I thought it would be easier or take less time than drawing. And, that's not at all true. And there was a huge learning curve, and I didn't know how to learn what I needed to learn because I didn't know what I needed to learn. So I had to learn to sew. I don't even know how to cook. I don't know how to do any of those things. But I had to get a sewing machine, learn how to sew a little clothing, learn what materials were, learn how to use power tools, and... Dick Siegel's there. He sang a song I was just thinking about what we were doing in that situation. We had to turn him around because he was singing a song as we were shooting him. But he's really good. So it's not at all easy, and I do get frustrated when I feel that my abilities are not developed enough and they hinder me. But generally, I just keep trying to do it right until I get it. Everything takes me forever, I must say. So
When you find yourself at that moment where you think, I know what I need to do, but I don't know how to learn how to do it, do you find yourself relying on models or exemplars, or do you just throw yourself in the deep end and figure out you'll just eventually establish a way to do it on your own? Because with the drawing, of course, you know, you've mentioned that a lot of the comics you were exposed to when you were young did at least give you something to kind of imitate or push against or engage with directly.
Right.
So when you're entering things like doll making or sewing or, you know, setting up installations for photography, are you just drawing on the general wellspring of all the art you've been exposed to? Or do you go looking for models?
So you're not talking about how to do it, but you're talking about what it looks like.
Yeah, I guess the questions are related in some way, right? In order to figure out how you want it to look, you can be compelled partly just by some incomplete vision in your own head, or you can think, I want combinations of X, Y, and Z. I've seen versions of this here, there, and elsewhere. How do I synthesize or integrate them?
Well, I think initially I don't have a vision of what I want. And I don't think I want this, and so I don't do that. I just kind of experiment until it feels right. And then from there, I'll go and refine it further. Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
But you know, there's so much precedent. I mean, there are drawings. Dolls. I mean, people have made dolls since, you know, since people were born. And building little miniatures, I mean, you can find those in Egyptian tombs and probably well before then, I suppose. So people have always been fascinated by miniature things. So I've got a lot to look at in that sense. But the end product is not the miniature. It is the story. So
The effect?
You mean?
Yeah, how once the emphasis isn't at the end of the day on the particular details of the production, but what cumulatively, finally, the story it tells or the effect that it
makes. Right, because it's a novel. So if you get too hung up on like sewing, which I sometimes do, I mean, you know, you can't. It's a novel, and it really is, you know, a novel. And then there's all these things that get in your way because, you know, this character, their nose just isn't right. And I was going to swear just now, and I didn't. And that's weird because it doesn't sound like me. No, but I'm constantly tweaking little details. I mean, I've always been, I was a medical illustrator. I mean, I've always been like obsessed with details, which is, it shows, I think, in my style, but it's kind of an impediment because you never let anything go until every little thing feels right. It's hard to forgive any, you know, omission. Yes.
That makes me wonder if, as you're experimenting, what you do with the material that you discard. Because I assume there's a difference between having many drafts of something that you're drawing and deciding whether or not you want to keep those drafts, and how you would keep evidence of a process that you were constantly revising.
Yeah.
So do you document as you go, or do you just keep sticking with it until you're done?
Well, I really regret not documenting it, because I have like 30...
All right, everyone, save your work.
Yeah, you do have to. Or take a picture, because it's like I have like 35 dolls now. And when I started making them in the beginning, I wasn't thinking about animation, but then it became clear that, oh, this will work. So the early dolls have a certain kind of armature, and then later on I developed more complicated armatures, used some like professionally made armatures, which are really expensive and are never the right proportion, but I used part of them or something. And so, but I developed better ways to do it down the line. But a lot of times, like, I've been making a new series of heads.
Anyway. That is the best thing anyone has ever said. That is fantastic. What you been up to? I've been making a new series of heads.
And again, to communicate with my neighbor, the musician Dick Siegel, in the room, I was starting to make these heads, and I had made some like a year previous, and I couldn't remember how I made them. Because I had used a mixture of like styrofoam, paper clay, and epoxy clay, and I couldn't remember what order or what. I mean, I can't even describe, because I have all these like chemicals and substances, because I try everything. And you know, it took me like 3 days to figure out what the hell, I could say hell, how I did it. But then I figured it out. And so if I had taken pictures or taken notes, I would not have been at that disadvantage, and I probably would have, you know, had a couple more days free than I now have. And same with the armatures, because the way I make the dolls, a lot of them are felted. You can't see what's inside there after you make the doll. So you have to cut it open. Oh, and what do I do with the failures?
Yeah.
Like, if
process,
I...
process, discard stuff.
Yeah, if I like the body, but I don't like the head, I cut off the head.
This is going to make the best sequence of dissociated quips.
And also, the thing with felt, not all of the dolls are felted, but some of them are. And if you know how that works, you know, you're adding mohair and then sticking needles in it till it gets denser and denser. And so if I have a skinny doll and I wanted to make that skinny doll somebody else, you just kind of add fat to it and needle that in, and you can also cut the stuff afterwards and make it skinny again. So it's kind of really, you know, since I'm not making it to sell a doll, I can do anything I want with it just so it looks right for what I'm using it for. But you develop a relationship with these things. It's like a writer, when he or she has her characters, you identify with all of them. And if you don't, that's probably not your strongest character. I mean, you become the president, or, you know, I become the murderer who, in my book. You know, it's not pleasant. It's, like, really, really difficult. But these dolls, they, when I like the doll, I feel a real connection to it, as if it's alive. Which I know it isn't. But it's like, some of them I like really love, and it's almost like a love for a person, for a personality. And I wonder, I've been thinking about people, other people who do write novels. Anybody in this room? Anyway, well, in the world,
what I'm sure doesn't even go to the end of the page. Novel is far too complex.
Okay.
For the likes of me.
No, but you are, if you are creating a novel, whether it's based in reality or not, well, all of them are based in reality, you're creating a world. You are creating a world with things in it, with people in it, and you have to know so much more than what ends up in the book. You have to know details. You have to explain things. And, you know, and these people are living in your head, or you're writing about animals, whatever it is, they're in your head and they're living. And it's a challenge. You have to have time, because if you don't have time, you're constantly being interrupted, and it takes forever. Because every time you start again, you have to build that world up again. So you're believing it again. You can't just like run in and out. It doesn't work. And it takes very little to make that world just come crashing to the ground and shattering. And yeah.
I'm really curious about that in terms of emotional investment in the method. Right? So I'm wondering if you feel like there's ever a point at which there is where sunk cost is like no longer an option. In other words, just hypothetically speaking, you know, could you ever imagine proceeding with this project and then one day deciding, you know what? Not dolls. Dolls were useful to get me to this point, but it turns out that in order to make what I want to make, it's not going to be dolls at all. Or is there a point in any given project where you are locked in, right? Where the investment is so strong that the commitment means that you're going to follow through with that method?
You know, that's a really good question, and I've considered that. I've thought, like, you know, maybe this just has to stop, you know. But I think if I did that, I mean, my process kind of is my work. It's my way of getting close to what I'm doing. So if I did that, stopped using the dolls, then the dead and discarded dolls would be part of the book. I mean, they would represent some sort of failure or, you know, giving up. They would represent something, whatever made me do that.
But they would never disappear completely. They would just change in their function in the bigger story.
Yeah, they may not have any more function, but they would go as far as they went and then be left behind. But somehow,
yeah, so no erasing your steps as you go.
No.
So does broadly defined then, does just the concept of the novel, however you define or construct it, does that indicate for you the idea of an end point, right? There will be many processes and many different techniques in the assembly of whatever this novel is going to be, but one day, right, that will be done, and you'll be able to point to something and say, that is the novel version of what I wanted to do, and then you disengage or engage differently? No, I'm asking you to look into the future. Please look into the future for us.
No, every time I've completed a big project, I get, like, really depressed afterwards. Because you have no reason to live after that. I mean, in the sense that you really don't. I mean, if you've invested, like, 10 years of your life on one thing, you've been focusing on it. I mean, it depends how important your work is to you. I think, you know, maybe I'm so insecure or so, I don't know. My work kind of is me in many ways. So when it's over, like, who am I? It's really confusing. It's kind of depressing. I mean, there can be an elation, but it's also really confusing because you really have to redefine who you are. At least that's what I have found every time.
I actually have a question that I think might be related to that about the origin of what energy compels a given project. So I guess I'm thinking about how much of what you do depends on what you feel compelled to generate internally. Like, in other words, you were always going to do it. It was just something inside of you that you had to express. And how much depends on the circumstances of what you're exposed to. And I started thinking about this initially when I was thinking about how the diary depends equally on this deep, highly personal sensibility, like an actual voice or perspective. But it also just depends in some ways on chance, right? Being in San Francisco in the 1970s, encountering underground comics. How do those two forces interact? The story that kind of inheres within you to tell, and then wherever you happen to be, whatever materials are at hand.
Yeah, that's a good question. Well, I was thinking, I've been thinking about what is a book, okay? You have some kind of feeling that is probably impossible to describe verbally. I mean, well, like with this book about Mexico, I just had this like feeling of this whoosh. And I know exactly what that means. It's this whoosh, and there's things going under it. I can almost feel this structure, and it feels there's some emotion to it, and there's emotions that are going against each other. And so that's the sketch of this book. But I, you know, it sounds like I'm talking about nothing, but it's something that's very strong and compelling for me. And so with the diary, I mean, everything that happened to that girl was just happenstance. The feeling in it, if the events indeed caused the feelings, were also happenstance.
Oh, it's interesting.
But it's always the emotion, it is always the feeling, or...
So you feel it as profoundly intimate and personal, even if you understand on some level it is really just circumstance. And that it all could have been totally different in terms of how it played out when it's playing out.
Yeah, but that
nevertheless,
is...
That nevertheless becomes you.
But see, that's really important, because if that weren't true, then why would anyone read books? Because if it was so tied to the author, it would never be universal. It would not interest you. So the point, I mean, so for me, it doesn't...
No, I think that makes a lot of sense. I actually very much believe that. I mean, you know, and some people would present it as kind of a truism, but I think in experience, it's actually far more intimate, you know, that if you have any chance of achieving a universal effect, it depends entirely on your fidelity to what is incredibly specific. You know, you can't get to universal by being universal and abstract. You can only get there by being rooted, grounded, highly detailed, totally idiosyncratic, mm-hmm. and that's really the only way in. I believe that.
I think you said that really well.
we have everything on lockdown this afternoon. One of the things I'm curious about as well, especially considering the very high level of personal investment, is the fact that you have also collaborated a lot, and you have now seen your work adapted in a couple of different ways. What is that like for you? How does it alter your ideas of process or authorship?
Well, I can't think of the film as a collaboration, because at some point, because that Diary of a Teenage Girl, you know, it came out of me or whatever. I didn't make it up, so any kind of interpretation of the character by someone else, I could invariably say, no, that's wrong, or no, it. You know, I know the director really well now, and for 8 years we've been, like, communicating. She's come here, she's stayed at my house, looked at all my papers.
She did a stage version as well.
She
both directed it and played Minnie.
Yeah, she did. Yeah. No, she's fantastic. And, I mean, just going back a little further, I mean, there were several directors who asked to make a movie of that book. And, you know, there were... After I read scripts or heard what they were going to do, I said, I can't do this. I can't do it. No.
Yeah, I can easily see how if that was going to go wrong, it was going to go wrong catastrophically.
Yeah.
Not a little bit wrong,
no.
But all the wrong.
Oh, it could have been so bad. Or even not bad, but so wrong in terms of what I felt my book meant and what... Mm. Anyway, so... But after time, you know, she was sending me scripts and saying, can you read this and da-da-da. But I couldn't do it anymore, because every time my criticism was like, no, I would do it this way. Not because it was right or wrong, because I felt it should be that way. I really did. But then I thought, no, wait, in context of how she responded to the book, what that book means to her, this is working. But I can't even speak to that. I should just, like, let her do it, because otherwise it's just like... It doesn't make any sense. And plus, I can't even think about that book anymore, so let's just let her do it. So I did, and it's good. And
So without obviously wanting to overwrite any of her methods or techniques or choices, is the first most important element then simply that when she was reflecting her response to it, that you saw in that reflection something where, unlike the other directors of scripts, you thought, yep, and that is more in line with how I experienced it, so...
Well, no, that's not exactly what happened. What happened is these other directors wanted to do it. That was a long time ago, and suddenly I got this letter from Marielle Heller, and she wrote to me, and she said, I love your book. And she asked me if she could make a theatrical play of the book. And I read that, and I thought... this person is crazy. There's no way on earth this could be a play. And I actually thought it was funny. I was like chuckling to myself. And I just like wrote back to him, you know, knock yourself out. If you think you can do it, you know. And I just couldn't imagine it going anywhere. And in fact, it did go somewhere. Not only was she good, but she was connected, and so she could, you know, get help, like, making things happen. And she invited me to the first read-through after she had written the play, and that was in Los Angeles. And I wasn't going to go. I was afraid to go. I was literally afraid to go. But then the day before the reading, I just got a ticket, and I went to Los Angeles. And I was really upset. I was just like, my heart was pounding. I didn't want to see it, but I felt like I should see it. And I stayed in the hotel room where Janis Joplin died. And Janis Joplin is my hero. I mean, I love Janis Joplin. And but I always have.
Don't you have a really interesting quote somewhere about your relationship to her? And then when you're talking about her death, I think you said something like, "I feel like she died for me."
Sometimes I say things that are funny when I hear them. I mean, I don't. Yeah, it sounds.
My powers of research are imperfect. I could have just made that up.
Yeah, well, it's almost Easter, so that's anyway.
A new tradition, everyone.
No, but I stayed in that room, and it took a while to find it because it changed names 100 times because it's owned by Chinese, and if someone dies in a room, it's really hard to sell. I don't know. There's some, so they changed the name to efface that memory. But anyway, I stayed in there, and I felt so good. It made me feel so good. It was like going on a pilgrimage, I guess. And then I felt okay about going to the play. And I went to the play. And I was just crying during the whole thing. It was so weird. It was just like watching ghosts prance around on a stage. Like, I knew them. Why do I see them?
How can they actually be there?
Right. And it was really good. I mean, I thought, I don't go to many plays, okay? But I thought it was good. But I've seen a lot of movies, and that was her next step. So I felt really comfortable by that time saying.
Because of what the play established.
Yeah.
At that point, you were like, yep, she knows something.
She knows something. And of course, the play is absolutely different than a movie.
Sure.
It couldn't, you know. But that's good. It had to be. Yeah.
All right. I want to turn for a moment, if that's okay, to the relationship between your work and your job. So I read an interview with you where you mentioned that teaching can be strange for you because you knew you would never have gotten admitted to the University of Michigan given its current admission standards. And I totally empathize because I think I'm in the exact same position. As I've told all of my students, when I graduated high school, I knew 3 words, and they were dude, man, and God in combination. But nevertheless, here we are. And since so much of what you do is about figuring out how to do it, what's the consequence of that for your teaching practice?
Well, I don't know. It makes me a really bad teacher for some students, and it makes me a great teacher for others. I really don't teach well to both types of students, I don't think. I mean, the first part of your question, yes, I would not have gotten accepted to the University of Michigan.
I think we're just going to go ahead and judge the University of Michigan for that. That's clearly Michigan's hypothetical fault.
Well, and no, I just was a terrible student. I got kicked out of 3 high schools in it. Middle school, I guess, and
but not in that order. It wasn't that bad.
And I never got my undergraduate degree, but I got my graduate degree, and that wasn't because I was trying to trick anybody. It's just that I got accepted to graduate school before I graduated. That's typical, right? But then I just never finished that semester.
And they.
Don't do that.
Yes, I'm seeing looks of sinister hope flash across many faces. Yeah.
No, but I honestly genius. I don't know how I got away with that. I don't even know if I got away with anything, but I don't. But like when they're interviewing
this
me.
This nightmare vision of the phone ringing right now from your undergraduate institution saying, "Excuse me, is Phoebe there?"
That was San Francisco State University. Okay, call me. No, but I didn't like try to cover it up. Instead of undergraduate degree, I put undergraduate work at this school. You know, I never lied about it.
And even, words matter.
No, but when they asked me to, you know, they told me they'd hire me if I wanted them to hire me. I said, well, you know, I don't have an undergraduate degree, and the dean said, yes, I know. And I just felt like he was God or something.
Approaching Janis Joplin powers of resurrection at that point.
Right. But wait, oh, but students, okay.
Actual students.
Yeah, actual students. No, it's really hard because I don't think in a linear way. You know, I don't even know how to describe my thinking. It's hard to do that for yourself, but I don't. I don't, like I said, I don't make an outline and plan a story. I don't know how it's going to end. It's, you know, I just struggle with it. And a lot of students, rightly, I believe, really need that structure when they're doing a story. But I don't know how to do that. So sometimes I have guests come in. And like
for
other cartoonists,
day.
Yeah, I get those other kinds of cartoonists to come in and talk to those. You know, no, it's true. I have to because I just. But on the other hand, there are students like me, who learn how to do things themselves and figure it out somehow or another, and get real confused by planning, don't understand dates or time. yeah.
So of all the classes you've taught thus far, do you feel like there's one that did have a particularly effective design, or like in some ways the mandate of the class really enabled you to get that right mix of students doing their best work?
I don't know. I feel like, I mean, I think they always do good work. I mean, I'm just happy if they get better than they were, if they learn something. But see, the thing with teaching comics, it's kind of ridiculous. I mean, you have to have lots of different skills. You have to be a designer. You have to be an illustrator or a painter. You have to be a writer. And you have to be a cartoonist. You have to have read a lot. You have to continue to read, not just comics, but novels. There's all of these skills, and then, you know, the hand skills of, like, you know, drawing with ink and things like that. And then you have to be able to scan and to adjust things in the computer and put things together and know what typography looks like and when it looks bad. You know, all of those things. So I feel like when I get students, sometimes they have all levels of experience or understanding. It's like teaching a one-room schoolhouse. Because everyone's up to the same end, but, you know, one teacher can't teach a student to do all of those things, a group of students. You just can't. And the story itself is, you know, you need so much time. I have them do 5-page stories, a few of those in a semester, and it's really hard to read 20 of those and, you know, edit them or critique them in a meaningful way, or even to have critiques, because you have to either print the work out or put it online so everybody can read it before the critique, because people can't read it during the critique. I mean, it's just like, it's really hard. So sometimes I just like say, I kind of mimic how I learned. It's like on the first day of class, I'll say a few things, and I said, well, I want you to do a 5-page story. And they're like, okay, when? And I said, well, just start it tomorrow. and we'll pick a topic. And
yeah, relax tonight. Start it tomorrow.
No, I don't, but I purposely don't give much guidance because once you give any guidance, they're no longer trying to figure out how to do it. And they freeze when you tell them it's totally open, but they also freeze when you suddenly tell them they have to do this and this and this. But I think they do better work when you don't give them too much.
When it's not just a checklist.
Right. Yeah, you just say, go do it. It's like trial by fire.
if there was a formula, I'd be using it.
Right.
I'd be at home following that.
Yeah.
We have a tradition, if you've done it once. It's the beginning of a tradition. We have some customized questions a la the absurdity of Inside the Actor Studio. So I'm going to ask you to indulge just a few of these. And the first is, what excites you as a writer?
You mean to read stuff or to write?
As a writer.
Okay, as a writer. Not a writer who reads, but a writer who writes.
I'm going to ask that question in moments.
Okay. What excites me as a writer? I just love how arbitrary meaning is. It's like sometimes when I'm writing, I think, oh, God, this is not even grammatically correct, or this sounds so stupid, or hackneyed. What is that phrase I'm using? My God, so stupid. But then I realized that you could substitute another word or another set of words that means the same thing, or does. I mean, I don't know. It's just fun. It's like juggling or something. But then there's several kinds of writing. There's writing about emotions or abstract things or things that don't exist, and then there's writing about details of places and stuff. And I think, I mean, all those things interest me. It's like getting the balance between the mind and the body, or the ethereal and the whatever the opposite of that is.
Corporeal.
There you go.
What about the other end of the question? What excites you as a reader?
I don't know. I get to pat myself on the back after reading a book, like, and say, look, Phoebe, you know how to read. but also... I don't know. I like to read. Sometimes I go through periods where I don't read at all. And that's usually when I'm thinking, when I'm confused about what I'm doing. I don't want other stuff in my head. So I have to figure things out, and then I start reading more afterwards. What excites me? I mean, I don't know. I always think about what books are, and, you know, this idea of a world and something self-contained is really the best definition I can think of. I mean, I've read several books lately that I was really excited about, but then I couldn't quite say why. And that really bothered me. And so then I wrote to the author, and I asked him if I could interview him.
Authors love this, by the way. Totally do this.
They do. No, but this guy is self-published. His name is Guillermo Paxton. I think he's really good. He writes these, like, they're kind of detective, cop, narco, thriller novels that take place in Juarez and El Paso. But he's self-published. It's like no one's ever heard of him. But I just happened to read one of these things, and then he sent me another and another, you know, with misspellings and stuff, because you don't get an editor, you know, if you get self-published. But I was thinking, why do I like these so much? They have a lot of energy. And do I just like them because they're about Juarez, or is there something else? And I think there is something else, but I had to talk to him to kind of, like,
figure out what it was.
Yeah. All right.
Excellent. Okay, one last pair of questions, and then I want to hand questions over to the audience. So the first is, what profession, if any, other than your own, would you like to attempt? Alternate universe Phoebes, what are they doing?
Well, I know, I thought this, if I had been born a man or even a boy or a baby boy, I feel I would have been a criminal. No, but it's true. I'm not sure why.
Now I'm wondering if I had been born a woman or a girl, I would not have been a criminal.
No, but I say that I'm a lot like my father, who's dead. But I'm
just
not dead.
In that way.
And no, but he was this crazy artist guy. But he had all these like ailments that young men have. He liked to drive fast cars, play with guns, take drugs, and drink beer. But yet he was like a great artist. And, you know, he died fairly young as a result of all this other stuff. And he had trouble with the law. So, I don't know, I just imagine that. And he also, he boxed and got into fights. I mean, I guess I identified with him on some level so much. And I know I had a similar energy growing up as he did. So I think I would...
Outlaw. All right, then the follow-up inevitably is, what profession other than your own would you absolutely not want to attempt? Anything but that.
Sales.
All right. Fantastic. On that, I want to give the audience an opportunity to ask any questions. If you're listening to this, I can tell you everyone has raised their hand.
Yeah.
Yes, ma'am.
Hi, Phoebe.
Hi.
I'm Caitlin. I'm a student here. I was wondering if you have a favorite piece of writing above criminal
Do I recommend a reading for you, Caitlin?
Yeah.
Have you read Notes from Underground?
No.
Okay, read that. It's Dostoevsky.
Okay.
Okay.
Notes from Underground?
Yeah, it's a short one, but it's good.
Cool.
This is like everyone's birthday. You'll get customized recommendations. Do we have any other questions? Just because people are listening to this doesn't mean I can't see you. I can see you. Yes.
How did your career or initial career as a medical illustrator inform or perhaps not inform your future aspirations?
Well, the thing is, I think what drove me to do that was what drove me to do other things. So it's got a similar origin. A lot of my work is kind of, I don't even know if this is true, but it feels like it to me. It's kind of psychological. It's about characters and things like that. Medical illustration is obviously about bodies and interiors. And I think I was so much in my head as a young person that I felt imbalanced. I wanted to know what goes on inside when I eat or do other things. And I couldn't visualize it. I needed to know not only what was in my head, but what a head was and what was in here and, you know, under my ribs and stuff like that. So it was this, it's not that I even wanted to do that as a profession, although I knew that would probably allow me to support myself at least somehow. I just wanted to know those things. I wanted to, you know, go to autopsies and surgery and, you know, yeah.
Any other questions?
I have a question.
Are you prepared to answer your question?
It's for this young man right there. He's got this beautiful shirt on. It's kind of a teal color, but it's kind of shiny. I don't know.
It's very much
that?
In a shark skin suit style, Evan.
I'm not sure if I even remember. Macy's, maybe?
Really?
No, if you're going to say you don't remember, say, I just woke up. I don't know where I had been, but I was wearing this shirt.
Okay. Okay.
All right. Well, then we're going to end on a visual component for our radio program. I want to thank all of you for being here. Thank you again to Literati and WCBN. I am Raymond McDaniel for the Sweetland Center for Writing. Thank you so much for being here. And Phoebe, thank you.
Thank you.